Greetings. This is Jane Hoffman from Blog Talk Radio. Don Gallimore and Al will be joining us tonight, and we will be reviewing Hacking Democracy and Other Voter Machine Glitches, which contribute heavily to the increasing problem of voter accuracy. We are examining a documentary that was produced about the overall negligence of voter fraud, which was created by companies such as Diebold, who do not share their software technology, and they make it a secret to conceal information from the public. Worse, there's a breakage in how votes are collected to the point on how we can examine if they're accurately counted. Some companies have hard drives that we cannot examine, and some have other devices that they keep secret from the public. While watching this video, and I will bring Alan in a minute and Don, while watching this video, I gathered some basic thoughts. First of all, there was a woman named Bev Harris who became interested in voting machine glitches once she discovered that it was a nationwide problem. So she began blogging about it and trying to find out information. She stumbled upon a website in which she was able to actually download over a 40-hour period all the Diebold software technology. And within that technology, she noticed there was discrepancy in accuracy, reporting, and trying to fix problems that already existed. They also featured a political candidate in Louisiana who went into a warehouse area and through an old, it kind of looked like an old computer-generated word processing machine. She discovered by punching her own name in, another candidate's name popped up. This led to the suspicion that there is software tampering and a malicious software that can alter the votes. Cyber Incorporated, which is located in Huntsville, Alabama, has a computer specialist named Sean Southworth who writes reports, but will not, which are not disclosed to the public. And basically, what he does is he calculates the results of testing and vendor retesting, and makes suggestions to the companies on how to fix their problems. One of these companies is Cyber Incorporated. Now, he was trying to be standoffish during the interview, but basically he said that all he does is write the report and review the codes for the FEC standards. But the basic situation is this. He can only make recommendations. He can't authorize or unauthorize anything. There's also three key players in this movie. One is Kathleen Wynne, the associate director in a Midwestern state of black box voting. And there was another guy named Andrew Stevenson who got in touch with Bev Harris through her blog. And he's the associate director in another state of black box voting in which he also ran for public office. And all these three people together kind of got together and they basically tried to find investigative techniques to discover all the problems in Diebold's software. They also found a letter from the CEO from Ohio. His name was Wally O'Dell, and he promised the George Bush campaign in the last election that he ran in, which was 2004. He promised them that he would deliver Ohio for them. I was basically shocked that his public relations man actually admitted this and said that Wally O'Dell, the CEO, had bias in who he wanted to choose. Basically, in fairness to the organization, though, Bev Harris said that Maryland and Georgia lean towards Democrat voter fraud for the Democratic Party, and other states, it goes both ways. Both the Republicans and the Democrats are capable of fraud. David Jefferson, the Secretary of State in California, said that all the voting machines used in a particular year were not certified. They ignored the law. They didn't seek proper channels of approval. And that all the machines pretty much were invalidated, but it was too late. They had to use them for the election. So with that, Don just joined us, but I'm going to let Al make his own introduction. Don, I'll pull you in about 1 minute. Al, do you feel like the comments I made about reviewing Hacking Democracy were fairly accurate? You're on the air now.
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, you're on the air. I just gave my summary of what I saw in the movie so far. Did I sound pretty accurate?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's accurate. I mean, it's crazy, you know. I mean, back in the day, I mean, when that was looked at, you know, the government didn't do its own investigation, so it was left to an organizations like the Black Box with the lady from the main lady from the movie. They created the Black Box organization, a website and whatnot, and, you know, about looking up these votings, you know, improper voting stuff. And so, you know, it's crazy how that all is. But they're all, after all those, you know, going to court and take and, you know, and trying to do something about it, a couple of years back, I guess they kind of looked at it, the government kind of looked at it like, oh, well, you know, people are gaining on us or something, you know, about the D-Bolt, how D-Bolt's terrible, you know. And D-Bolt, and there's another company, actually, I have it, I have a recording here, I don't know if you can hear it, let me post this from my phone. Oh, no, never mind, it won't work.
Can I just pause? Don, we're going to pull you in a minute. He wants to do an intro. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead with your audio. You can play your audio.
No, it won't let me. I was trying to do it with my smartphone, but it won't let me transfer the audio to here. It seems like on this smartphone, I can only do one audio at a time. Like the phone, so I won't let me do that one.
Well,
we can
just relay our information directly.
Yeah. So anyways, you know, after all that, you know, even after the recount, I mean, George Bush against forgot his name. But anyways, after the recount and all that they looked at, you know, a couple of years back, a couple years after that, they developed the Democrats developed the super delegates, and then the Republicans got the they developed a similar thing as super, well, the same thing as super delegates, but they call it different. They call it unpledged delegates. And here's the thing: that, okay, even though for many decades the Democrats and Republicans had delegates, but they never had super delegates and unpledged delegates. This is a new way our two-party system has been running since 2008, and they didn't do that before in 2010, you know. And I think it's
why don't we pull Don is the Democratic chair of the Reno Sparks, Nevada area, so maybe he can shed some light on this. I didn't think it was as recent as 2010, so let's ask him.
Yeah.
Good evening, Don. Al and I are on the line. I've already done a two-minute scenario on the movie Hacking Democracy about three people from blackbox.org that kind of, like, intruded on these companies selling software to counties for voter tabulation. Have you been listening, Don? Don? Oh, God. Just a minute. I'm going to text him.
Yeah.
Okay, keep talking, Al.
Yeah, I'm just having some issues with my phone, too, because I was trying to do a couple of dance things on the smartphone that's having trouble. But, yeah, I mean, the Democrats didn't always used to have super delicate, and the Republicans didn't always used to have the other ones that are not, the same thing as super delegates, but But like I mentioned before, they're called unpledged delegates, so it's kind of the same thing. They didn't always used to have that. And I think why they put that in, because they, even if the voting went to a recount and it was a complete recount or something like that, it wouldn't matter that much, because the super delegates, as you're looking right now, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, just on the delegates alone, she's barely winning. And on the super, when it comes to the super delegates, she has almost all the super delegates. And because of that, there's a big margin of Hillary Clinton between Bernie Sanders. And I think that's unfair. And because the super delegates, let's put it this way.
Why do you think it's unfair to Sanders? Don is back on the line, but why do you think it's unfair to Sanders? And by the way, Don, you're on the air.
Okay. It's unfair to Sanders because the superdelegates don't have to answer to anybody. You see, when you go to vote in an election for a caucus, well, actually the caucus is kind of different than the primaries, because there's closed primaries and open primaries. But even in the caucus or open primaries and closed primaries, when you go to vote, you're basically telling the delegate who you want him to vote for. And so when the majority of the House or whatever is voting for, let's just say, Bernie Sanders, then the delegate has to look at Bernie Sanders and will probably most likely vote for Bernie Sanders because of the sway of the people.
Okay, I do have something to say about that.
The superdelegate doesn't even look at that. I'm just explaining for the audience that are listening. The superdelegates don't even listen to that, and they vote on their own without having to look at their majority. And I think that's unfair.
Don, I agree with what you say, Al, but I do have a comment. Don, earlier we were talking about voter tabulation and how counties hire corporations to, implement software for voting. As the Democratic chair of Reno Sparks, have you noticed any problems up there with voter tabulation? And then I'll go to Al's question next.
In terms of voter tabulation, the only problem that I saw as a precinct captain was the fact that people left. There are a considerable number of people at our precinct who left. We're in a caucus here in Nevada, and they just weren't able to stay. A lot of them, the caucuses opened at 11 o'clock, and because of computer glitches on registration side, everybody got pushed back pretty much an hour and a half almost. So we had people who were there at 12 o'clock still in line down the street, pretty much a block and a half, two blocks down. So that was a problem where we didn't have enough computers to register people at the start. If that were improved, we would have been able to have a lot more participation than we did. Other than that, there was no tabulation problem on the Democrat side that I've heard of. On the Republican side, they don't have to worry about tabulation because it is more of a primary type of vote. So except for the glitches, major glitches in registration, there really wasn't a problem that I saw.
Okay, good. Good answer. Now I'm going to go back to Al's comments on superdelegates. The only thing I can say from a pragmatic level, Al, is that you have to understand, now I'll use Mark Dayton as an example. He's been the governor of Minnesota for over 5 years. He worked with Hillary Clinton in the Senate, and he basically said on National Public Radio that his mind was made up that he's voting for Hillary even a year before she probably announced her candidacy. Now, in certain spheres, people have loyalties. The Clintons have been around. Bill Clinton took office in 1992. He was the governor of Arkansas all through the 80s. They've been in the public eye for 35, 40 years. In that case, when you have someone that strong and entrenched in politics, I'm pretty sure that the high-ranking Democrats, a lot of them a lot of them go automatically for the candidate. On the Republican side, it's not exactly so, because Ted Cruz is not that well-liked. There's no party establishment candidate this year. And even back in 2012, they spent a long time deciding whether they're really going to pick Mitt Romney or not. A lot of other people were doing pretty well for a long time. Like, I can't remember them all, but Rick Santorum did okay. Mike Huckabee did okay. But, you know, like, there was no consensus with the Republicans even back then. So I see your idealistic form of revenge, you know, like rage. Like, why can't people consider Bernie Sanders? Well, people probably have considered Bernie Sanders on some level. Like, they might ask themselves the question, why is Bernie Sanders doing so good when he was just an independent in the Senate and he had no party affiliation? So I think that Bernie Sanders, you know, by any stretch is making a strong showing. And right now, you as Joe Q citizen shouldn't worry about superdelegates. There's going to be a lot more drama unfolding between now and the convention.
Right, right, right. Well, I want to talk just a little bit about drama because, I mean, a lot of presidential candidates had you know, just protesters or just people show up at their rallies, especially Donald Trump. And even Bernie Sanders, you know, had some people from Black Lives Matter. But, here's the difference between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. When protesters showed up at Hillary Clinton's rally, they got kicked out. The people from Black Matters got kicked out. I saw those even in a YouTube video.
Really?
And also one time, yes. And also one time when Hillary Clinton had an enclosed a small get together, like a little, she was doing a fundraiser. Well, there was a girl named Ashley, a black girl named Ashley, was showed up with her sign and she protested. Well, she didn't really protest, but what she did is she asked Hillary Clinton a question. And because she asked Hillary Clinton a question while she was speaking and about the fundraiser, she got kicked out. So this girl named Ashley got kicked out. And she actually paid $500 to get in the fundraiser event. And
well,
so
that's too bad. I do have something to compare that to. There was they had a public event in Minneapolis with Mark Dayton and two senators there, Amy Klobuchar. And a black girl asked Hillary Clinton about Jamar Clark, which was an incident in Minneapolis where there was a police shooting. And then Hillary answered like five of her questions. And then the girl got testy with Hillary Clinton. And I guess Clinton got fed up and she said, well, why don't you run for public office? Why don't you consider running for public office yourself? And then she said in the next breath, I'm sorry you were dissatisfied with me as a voter, but this is the reality. You know, like she wasn't being rude, but she wasn't mincing words. She just got kind of burned out and with the person asking the questions. And then the Minneapolis Tribune went ahead and printed the story. Now, if you're in a fundraiser, I used to live in North Hollywood, and Barack Obama used to go up in the Hollywood Hills like for parties at George Clooney's house. And no one could get anywhere near those parties unless you were a high-paying donor. One time I got stuck in Laurel Canyon. Clooney was having a party, and I was pretty much stuck on the canyon for like 2 hours. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that I couldn't have like just parked my car on the side of the road and walked up to the party. You know, I mean, let's face it, there's a pecking order, and I'm sure Don knows about it because he's met a lot of big wigs.
Yep. But here's a quick, for the audience, a girl named Ashley, she was holding up the sign that said, we have to bring them to heel. And it was something that Hillary Clinton said a long time ago, so if they want to look up that video, they can look it up on YouTube with those words. So go ahead.
Well, Don, can you weigh in on political pedigree for a minute?
Oh, sure. That's no problem. We have four families in America that are kind of monarchical, if that's a word. They are the Bushes, the Clintons, the Obamas, and the Kennedys. And those families are chock full of kids who have become politicians too. Being a journalist, I've interviewed Teddy Kennedy. That was probably my biggest interview ever. I was able to interview him back in the day. But those families are entrenched in American culture right now. And until one of them is out of politics, it's going to be like that for a little while. The Obamas, as I mentioned before in a previous show, will probably go on to the UN. I don't think he's going to go to the Supreme Court, even though he's qualified. I think he'll go to the UN and make a global presence of the Obama family. So that's going to just exacerbate the monarchical concept of the family. The Kennedys are dying. They have, I don't know if they're cursed, if you want to call it that, or whatever the case may be, but they are not going to be the same kind of players in politics that they have been in the past for some time.
Why did you put Obama in that category? He's only been around 8 years. It's not like his mother was a blue blood or anything like that.
Because of his entrenchment already. He's made the biggest strides. Nothing. He's nouveau riche, if you want to call it that, the new rich. But he will continue to bring his family along as a political force in American politics. So that's one of the reasons why he is tentatively part of that monarchy that fills some of the American landscape. But he will continue striving for a place in American history along with his wife and his children. I don't think Michelle's going anywhere. I think she, in fact, might look for some kind of a cabinet position in the future, things like that. You know, so that they're probably going to be part of that triumvirate and make it a quartet.
If I were an Obama, I'd carry my butt back to Indonesia and say, screw America. I feel like a lot of times they were treated terribly.
They were treated. They're still treated terribly. I mean, what do you think the Supreme Court nomination is about? It's about him trying to get back at the people who have done him wrong, and this is the greatest way to do that is with this questionable Scalia death. It could have been murder. It could have been just a suicide, or not a suicide, but just a death, murder, natural causes. But this is going to prove out to be his out, or his way of getting back this one appointment, and then he might, as a matter of fact, campaign in some ways for Hillary in the next couple of months to assure that she has that other three potential Supreme Court appointments. Therefore, we'll have a 5-4 court, and that'll be extremely significant for not only the next 4, maybe 8, 16, 25 years. And that's what this whole thing is about, because the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, yada, yada, they're all for stacking the Supreme Court. That's their whole purpose right now. They know the presidency, and this is what I've said too, the presidency doesn't make that much of a difference. The checks and balances will stop anyone from trying to go overboard, step over their limits. And the Senate and the House are more important. But right now, the Supreme Court, with the laws that are being written and that have to be adjudicated, especially gay rights, gay marriage, affirmative action, voting rights, things like that, those are the things that are going to be coming down the pike, and we're going to really need to have some level heads on the bench to be able to traverse some of these laws that are coming up.
I don't even want, you know, I heard something on actually 8:50 a.m. today about the Supreme Court. there's so much bitterness just in the fact that Obama wants to nominate somebody. I can barely stand listening to radio shows dealing with that. It's so depressing.
That's because they don't have an argument. It's the sickest thing in the world when you can let Ronald Reagan appoint someone in his lame duck last few months, and you can't let Obama do the same thing. You know,
was it Sandra Day O'Connor that he nominated?
I don't believe so. Think it was Sandra Day.
Well, let's give
Kennedy,
Alan Crack
Justice
at
Kennedy.
The stage. Okay.
I believe it was Justice Kennedy.
Cool.
It was Justice Kennedy.
Let's have Al have a crack at the conversation.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can call me Albert, yeah.
Okay, sorry, Albert.
Yeah. When you were talking about, Barack Obama, he has made the most executive orders than any other president, you know. And, you know, by him doing so many executive orders will tell you that he can't communicate that well with, you know, with the whole Senate, you know, the whole Congress and all those people. He can't communicate well with them. That's why he's got to do executive orders, because they don't listen to him. And another thing, you know, Barack Obama has done, like, one of the opposite things to what he said he was going to do. Like, for instance, he has, in 2008, when he was running on and became president, he was going to close down Guantanamo Bay Prison. And then a couple of years later, he said he wanted to increase the detention time to 30 years. And so Guantanamo Bay Prison is a detention torture prison. So he's kind of the opposite on some agendas, which is kind of really contradicting. So that's my take on Barack Obama.
I hear what you're saying, but... So are you for or against closing Guantanamo?
Oh, closing it, of course.
Me?
I want to close it or at least put a justice system.
I meant Albert, Don.
When it comes to Guantanamo Bay Prison, I know all the other countries. We have an agreement in all the other countries that when we capture prisoners, they don't have to abide by our laws like our citizens. So when we capture prisoners from other countries and we put them on Guantanamo Bay, they don't have to go the same thing our citizens go to, the due court process, innocent and proven guilty. And they have to be they can be tortured, but they can't. There's some specific rules about that, and they do waterboarding. But here's the thing, okay? Even no matter how you look at it, okay? I mean, they could have been at the wrong place at the wrong time, you know? And even though, and here's how you look at it. Guantanamo Bay used to be a secret prison, you know. And it was a secret prison for a while until a Bradley Manning exposed them and leaked it to the WikiLeaks. It showed up on WikiLeaks about Guantanamo Bay and all the prisoners they were in there and stuff like that. That's how we kind of found out about it. And we found out about other stuff, too. It shows you how our government works. Like, I mean, if the other countries are doing it too, then why is America keeping Guantanamo Bay a prison to us, a secret to? Why was it keeping it a secret to us before if all the other countries are doing it too? I mean, what's the point then? You know what I mean?
I think, you know, Guantanamo Bay has been, it's been a Navy base there for years. And George Bush had a lot of agendas back when this 9/11 thing started. They had to figure out how they were going to manage these potential and actual terrorists. They had to decide between waterboarding and all these other things. And there was a lot of paranoia back then. And people were afraid. And now things have cooled off, even though 14 people were killed in San Bernardino recently. But... I'm pretty sure there's a lot of hardliners left on terrorism, but I work for a lot of nonprofits. In 2008, we had to do calls for the ACLU and stuff, and a lot of those prisoners were held there with no charges for over, it's been 5 to 10 to 13 years now, and Half of them probably have died off by now, and how can there be that even that many left? I don't know.
There's 91 people in there right now. Yeah, and 35 are set for release, but they're still in there. But yeah, almost everybody, about like 99% of Guantanamo Bay prisoners, they don't go through the due court process. Yeah, that's in Guantanamo Bay. But you know, I don't want to talk about even our local. Let's just compare Guantanamo Bay, which is
I haven't really dealt with that issue for many years, but I just think even if you're a potential terrorist, you have the right to know what's being charged against you. If they have sketchy information and they don't know if you're a terrorist, then you shouldn't really have to sit there for 13 to 15 years. I mean, that's a violation of human rights, and we're supposed to be the country that upholds human rights, which can be a joke on many levels.
The national agreement was up to a month, and we've been holding prisoners for many years, and the national agreement was supposed to be a month. So we don't, the United States doesn't even do stuff that agrees with, you know, nationally. So what's the point? Yeah.
By the way, they just arrested someone in Belgium today.
Yeah.
I guess they, yeah. So
Belgium,
that,
France.
Europe
yeah,
is
shot him
still
in the leg
dealing
and took
on
him out.
That. Yeah. Europe's still dealing with a lot of upfront issues, you know, based on their recent range of attacks in the last 2 years.
They said that guy, that he was supposed to commit suicide, but he didn't. He was one of the guys from the shooting over there at the stadium a couple months ago, and he didn't show up. He was the driver that dropped him off, and his brother killed himself there at the. He blew himself up, but he's the one that didn't blow himself up. So they barely found out about him and came over and, you know, took him out and shot him in the leg. But that's the short story of it.
Okay, well, Don, how's work going tonight? Don? Oh, God, he keeps falling off the radar. Okay, anyway, so what else do you guys want to talk about tonight?
Well, I'd like to talk about our prisons. Here's three main things that I have kind of looked at and brought upon our local prisons. Now, the thing about our local prisons, okay, America has more people in prison than any other country. And not only that, our prisons are extremely disproportionate on black people, you know, more. And another thing, our prisons are privatized, and they've been that way for a while, and they're being more of our prisons are being more privatized. And what it is basically, you know, prisoners working for like a quarter or 50 cents an hour in prison while companies make money. And that's, for me, that's like a new way of slavery, you know, and I don't like that, you know. And, you know, it's just really wrong, you know, the things that I looked at. So what is your take on that?
Go ahead.
Hello?
Don?
Can you hear me?
I heard what you said, but I was trying to get, you know, people
here,
in the...
I have a fact right here. I like to...
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
The population in United States of America is 308 million people, but we have 2,297 400 people in prison. Now, if you look at that, let me look at that. And if you look at our black people to our ratio, I'm looking at a different scale here.
Well,
if you look at
a very well-known
common
fact that black people are only 13% of the country and they're about 40% incarceration.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm looking at it right here. Worldwide, worldwide, we hold one out of four prisoners worldwide. That's worldwide. And I'm looking at black people right now. Just in black people in general, it said that one out of three black people would end up in jail. That's the estimate.
That's from
a lifetime likelihood of imprisonment. I got this from the Senate Project, the Feminine Project. Yeah.
I do have a comment about that, but I want to make sure Don is still listening. Don? Okay, I'm going to put him on mute for a while because if he doesn't respond, he's toast. Anyway, maybe he put us on mute.
Here's one more thing that I'd like to say.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about John just called in. Hey, wait, you got to hold on a second because we have more callers, okay? I was going to – John is on the line. John, we'll pull you in a second. Don is not responding. Wake up, Don. Anyways, I lived in Virginia for 2.5 years in Norfolk, Virginia, and I worked in public housing, 400 – Don, you're toast, okay?
I'm not toast. I had to take care of some business. I'm at work.
Okay, well, John just called in now because I invited him. And you need a...
Good.
Just give me
You need some
seconds.
Kind of coffee aroma to keep you alert because you keep dipping in and out like the Loch Ness Monster.
No, I would never Loch Ness on you, baby. You know that.
Okay, well... I have one thing to tell Albert, and then we're going to pull John in. I lived in a public house. I worked in Portsmouth, Virginia in 1985 in a 400-unit public housing. Out of 400 units, 399 were black. And I had a black – there was a 20-year-old kid. I can't remember his name now, but he wrote an article for my newsletters. And the basis of the article was called The Blues and Whites. And it was about how the cops rolled in there about every 2 days and try to look for criminals, you know, would find any kind of way to try to find arrest people and how they were scared to death the local law enforcement. Now, this is coming from a 20-year-old black kid who was a passive in the South where blacks tended to be more passive than other blacks in other parts of the country. They didn't play around. They did exactly what the cops told them. They were submissive, and that was the overriding sense of fear that they had of law enforcement. Now, down there in the South, you know, it wasn't like a big drug war back then or anything. It was just a quiet relationship between the whites and the blacks. And they even called me Miss Jane, and I was a white 25-year-old. So they submitted to me without me even asking them to be like that. And that was their mentality. I'll let other people comment, but we're going to say good evening to John. Hi, John. How's it going?
I thought I was calling in to order pizza, and instead I'm in the middle of a race war.
Yes, you are.
We have Don the Loch Ness Monster, Jane the High Roller, and Albert the well-educated activist.
Wow. Well, I spent this afternoon talking to someone who's doing a lot of research into the metaphysical world, and they believe kind of into the revelations and the apocalypse, and they believe, you know, things regarding the Illuminati, the New World Order, and with a couple twists on it, but it was such a dark conversation because they started to get into the Matrix, like everything you see is not real, it's a perception, and there's a spiritual underworld that you're unaware of, and it was actually a great conversation. I enjoyed it, but it kind of, when you delve into other conversations regarding black and white, it's interesting. Everyone has a perspective, and that perspective or that angle influences your whole trajectory of what's right, what's wrong, what's fair, what's good. So I missed a little bit of it, but I don't come from the viewpoint that I'm a African-American male living in the hood. I'm a Hispanic, half white, half Mexican who grew up on the east side of San Jose. So I know a little bit about racial prejudice, but not to the degree that, you know, others have experienced. So I don't know. I think,
well,
Don has a different...
We actually just got on the race topic because Albert was talking about prison statistics, that 1 in 3 blacks will be arrested in their lifetime, and that America houses 1/4 of all prison, prisoners. So we had just gotten on that topic.
On a different view of that, you can look at the America holds 4% of the world's population, but they hold 25% of the people in prison of the world.
Right.
Wow.
Well, you know,
this is normal. I don't know why there is such concern or shock or whatever the case may be. The reason the black guys called Miss Jane is because they know that there's going to be a point where Miss Jane might call in NASA and they're going to get whipped or killed or, taken from their family. This is just the reality of black men's life. So you don't have to worry about hurting us because we've already been decimated. And that's just the way it is. But
this was 30 years ago, Don, in 1985.
This is the same.
It wasn't yesterday.
Almost the same thing. 1972.
I can tell you something real quick. We had 300,000 people in jail in 1972. In 2014, we now have 2,300 people in jail.
Right.
We can talk about the problems, just like we can talk about voter fraud, but we need to talk about the solutions.
Here's
a question I have, and that is, I understand police are going to look at minorities, especially a brother wearing a hoodie at 1 in the morning. They're going to be more suspicious of that person, even if they're innocent and don't do anything wrong. But the question I have is, someone ends up in prison, are the police actually, putting drugs in their hands and making them carry a gun into a store and rob in front of a camera? Or are brothers actually breaking the law and they're getting caught?
Well, the thing is, the laws for drug addiction are really terrible. It's terrible because, some people consider drugs to be a medical problem, not a criminal problem. And we are putting so many people in prisons for drug-related problems, and it's ridiculous. That's what I think.
And that's why I say this is normal. When you talk about black and white, the drug situation is about as black and white as you can get. When you talk about crack cocaine as opposed to powder cocaine, I think the penalties are like 4 times more on crack than they are powder. Powder has more cocaine in it, first of all, but it's also the same thing. And so there shouldn't be a difference in a sentence just because the same thing is packaged differently. That's ridiculous, and that shows you the white mentality of trying to keep the powder, which is mostly in the white communities, not mostly, but a larger part than crack cocaine, and crack being in the minority communities, they're being treated differently. The white people, they really suck, and when everybody understands that, then we have a chance to change the new paradigm. We have a chance to change the matrix to a more minority-based matrix based in love and concern about your fellow man instead of greed and avarice.
Yep. Well, the two running Democrats, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, have stated that drug addiction is not a criminal problem. I mean, it's not a criminal thing. It's actually a medical thing. They should be looked at as a medical problem, not a criminal thing, and put them in jail. So they actually want to change the law on that.
Well, that's what we're doing here in Nevada, in Reno especially, in Washoe County, is that we've got two different programs from three different sets of judges now. They're brand new diversion programs. And they're meant to keep them out of prison because, as I said, and you've got the oppressor, as I call him. You've got the oppressor up here, and he wants to put everybody in jail anyway, because he thinks it's a profit-making, profit motive, but it's not, and they know it in their heart. It takes $18,000 a year to house a prisoner in a prison. It takes $2,000 to $3,000 a year to keep a person in a diversion program.
Yeah,
you do the math.
Mm-hmm.
They
make money.
They could make prisons more profit based.
Yeah,
because
they're private prisons, they're making money.
Yeah, by the way, let's look. Just keep a friendly reminder to let John talk once in a while.
Friendly reminder.
Yeah,
John is coming in. He's coming in 3 minutes ago, and you're going to let him talk all day. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I'm 56 years old, and I have to say I'm a musician, so I'm exposed to the drug scene. In fact, half the people I play music with, even the ones that are Christians, are doing some form of narcotic or alcohol. But I have to say I haven't seen anyone in my personal life get cornered by a drug dealer and forced to take drugs, except, of course, there are sex trafficking where women are forced to take drugs and to be pimped.
Absolutely, and that's a huge number.
But it just seems to me, you know, we talk a lot about self-empowerment, about people making choices, about the power of the mind, and how strong the African-American race is, you know, in athletics, in achievement, in overcoming diversity. And then somebody conversation like, we're just powerless to not do drugs. If you put drugs in front of us, we have to take it. And the Chinese, the Koreans, the, you know, Asians, anyone else, they're kind of, they have a different code, but the black people have to take drugs. I don't buy into that. I think it's kind of, in a way, a racial prejudice. You know, it's like,
in
we
a
all
way, it really is.
Well,
it's
I have a white
way.
Nephew.
I mean, if you make an exclusion for African Americans regarding drugs, then it's in a way you're saying it's because of race. It's like, well, what about the other races? They have the same amount of drugs pumping around in the schools, in the clubs, in the colleges. And I'm not saying that
they got more in the schools and the colleges.
True, and I'm not saying economics doesn't affect it, because people take narcotics to numb themselves and escape, and obviously if you don't have money, if you have a bleak future, you're going to numb yourself. I get that. But I don't know. I hate to see lack of responsibility. Even if people are forced in a certain direction, I've seen people in bad, bad situations, drug-infested homes, and the kids come out and go, I'm not going to do drugs. I'm going to live a different life. And
exactly.
I've seen other people in privileged families go, and they're the worst people in the world. You know, it's like, I'm trying to understand it, but
you
I try not to bite.
You want to know what the best drug of all is? Xbox. Because of Xbox, Lauren has never tried alcohol, drugs, sex, or cigarettes.
Right.
And he's not in prison either.
No.
Right.
But his,
but I'm
but
just
his
saying
mind,
he hasn't
but his
even
mind
touched
is,
that realm.
But his mind is still as weak as if he was a doggone pothead at 8 to 17 years old, because those the frenetic movement, constant movement, especially from birth, of a visual can alter your mind. And it puts it in a state where it's always frenetic, so it doesn't have a chance to relax. ADD, ADHD, whatever A's they got out there.
That's a good that's a good point, John. Unfortunately, you burst my bubble.
Well, I probably have, but go ahead.
I meant
so
Lauren's bubble.
The Xbox?
What do you mean? Which bubble are you talking about? Lauren's bubble, because he's a good kid as long as he has direction in a situation that he's in. He's in an area that is primarily white, and so he's got to be the one to adjust to the situation.
To the dominant society?
Right, and as long as you are there to hold him, he's not going to be able to blossom. He needs to be able to do his own thing at some point, and that means
I've already had a meeting with his advisor yesterday about it, and he's expressly claimed exactly what type of independence he wants the minute he turns 18.
Okay, now 18 is not always the best age. You can think of 2021 where he has full privileges until whatever age he is now until 2021. That's what
well,
you
that's
have
not,
to.
There's a lot of factors involved, and I have three people on the line, so let's just skip that for tonight and save it for another night.
Okay.
Okay?
That's fine.
So Albert, why don't you weigh in on the demographics of Palm Desert and how you fit into that society? I'd like to hear a little more about you.
Well, in Palm Desert, we're actually building a new prison. It's getting bigger and huger. It's under construction. I passed by there like a month ago, and it's
you know where you live?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and not in Palm Desert. The prison's actually in Indio. Indio is only about 5 miles away from Palm Desert, so they're nearby cities within the Riverside County. But anyways, yeah, we're having our tax dollars here are going to a new prison. So just that's what I've seen, at least demographically when I've been driving around the courthouse. And I think that's just really wrong in my neighborhood for the money to be spent there.
Maybe the Mexicans are building a fortress to stop Donald Trump. Just kidding.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, the Hispanics are voting. They're voting for him. So don't think
that's
that
a bunch of crap. I read two articles in the LA Times that Donald Trump has no leverage in Los Angeles.
Well, they could afford to build the wall if they hire enough illegals to build it. Unfortunately, to cut
John, go ahead, John.
I leave because I have the Dark Master calling me. But it was quite interesting. I'll try to listen in and take it from here.
Thank you so much for calling, John. Bye.
Yeah, love you guys.
Bye, John.
Love you.
Talk
to you later, my
brother.
Later on, yeah.
It's Friday night party.
No.
Say no to drugs.
Say no to drugs. You damn,
okay,
damn right, Nancy.
Close to Nancy Reagan.
Nancy's dead, too, thank God. Huh?
Well, here's another thing. You know how Mexicans, you know, like, they can't vote if they don't have citizenship and whatnot? But, you know, prisoners can't vote either. And, you know, even no matter what crime you did, you can't vote. And look at this. Over there in Finland and Germany and other European countries.
They can vote in prison.
They can vote. They can come out of prison and vote. So why can't we do that here in the United States?
We can. We do. It depends on the class of the offense. And there's a term that time that you'll have to sit as a felon, and they will restore your voting rights upon petitioning the government, the Secretary of State. So we'd have that here. Now, you've got states like Texas and Florida that you can't. So, of course, the oppressor is not going to try to change that anytime soon, so that's going to be something that people have to change themselves. And when I say that, I mean they're going to have to really push. They're going to have to push to make those changes, and that's what
okay.
I do.
Here's another thing prison related that also related to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. That Hillary Clinton supports the death penalty, and Bernie Sanders does not. And death penalties, if you look at it, there's been death penalties where people have been, you know, executed, even though they later on have been proven innocent, you know. So what do you think about that?
It happens all the time. I don't even know what you just saw. You just saw the federal government, the district courts let go 243, I believe, prisoners that were wrongly convicted. And most of them terms of, I believe, over 13 years or something like that, falsely imprisoned, and up to like 25 or 30 years. So that, and that happens all the time, you know, before the advent of DNA testing and the it being admissible in court, that they were being sent to prison. They were, people were being sent to prison. That there were often two or three different
but the death penalty,
arrestees, same case. You know, you got three different people that they're arresting for the same case. And that happened quite a bit down south. You got one murder and you got three different people that they're going to indict. That doesn't even make sense.
And the death penalty even makes even less sense. Because, well, you know, you can't prove it or not. And you're right away rushing the death penalty. It's just really unmoral here. We gotta take away our death penalty nationwide in our country, because that people can be wrongfully executed. I don't know.
You gotta understand one thing though. There are people who are really, really, really bad. If you've never been, see, I've got like 13 degrees, and one of them is. Or two of them are out in the street.
Yeah, but that's why there's life terms.
There's,
you know what?
You know, the life terms are so expensive that it's unreal. And that's one of the reasons why they wanted to keep around the death penalty, is because the expense of getting rid of a prisoner as opposed to keeping them in turn is a huge difference. It could be 30 years. It could be 40 years that they're still in the prison system, whereas a death penalty, hey, 16 years that they complete their appeals process and they're done.
I have a point to make.
You actually make money in private prisons.
I have a point to make about the death penalty.
I'm going to have to go and close up. So I'll be back in a second.
Okay, sure.
All right.
Sure. Albert, a couple years ago in a state, I think it was either Alabama, Arkansas, or Texas, they did a lethal injection, and it was a faulty episode. So what happened was they did a lethal injection. It didn't work. And then for a couple months, they postponed all executions in that state. And then some states started rethinking the whole process and the most effective means to kill people. Now, a lot of states are anti, not every state in America allows executions. Did you know that? There's a lot of states that don't allow it. Texas is the highest.
Dependent on the states, yeah. The states get to choose whether they want death penalty or not, you know, but I think we should just completely demolish that and make it a whole, you know, countrywide rule of law.
Well, the reason why, like Don said, he was kind of giving the reason for efficiency, but there's two ways of looking at the lifeboat ethics. Like, let's say look at people in terms of a life raft. Say that the 4 billion people represent 40 in a lifeboat. If there's two bad eggs, you throw them off the lifeboat, because we can only sustain the planet for so many people, and we should sustain it for the good behaving people. Now, there's the other issue, which is what a lot of Catholic people promote, that human life is sacred from the cradle to the grave. So whether you are preventing abortion or a murderer from dying, you should preserve all human life. Where do you stand on that spectrum?
Well, I'm for, you know, I mean, if they did something really bad, of course, there's life terms in prison, and you can spend life term. But what about if, like, 20 years later or 30 years later, he was actually proven innocent, he never convicted the crime? Then at least he has an opportunity to be released from jail, like the people that they've been wrongfully accused. And therefore, if we had death penalties, they can, you know, they can be executed, and then later on we find out that person's innocent, now what? There's no reviving him. You can't bring him back from the tombstone, you know. So that's
yeah, there
why
has
believe-
been a lot of reversals in the last 5 years on people who were considered guilty but found innocent.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's the main reason about, you know, people that, you know, were considered guilty and then found innocent. That's my main reason why I'm against the death penalty.
Well, my main reason is I did watch that movie with Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon. I can't remember it now, but he was a death row inmate and she was a nun. And she pretty much stood by his side all the way till the end when he got executed. And it was basically about someone being humane to someone on death row, like treating them like a human, not just a piece of crap. And it was called Walking Something. But anyways, that movie made me more humble. And then I read about this case in Texas where this guy went in and he killed 4 people in cold blood. It was basically a burglary. And I think 2 of the people were younger, like under 20. And it just seemed like in the Old Testament, it says an eye for an eye and a tooth for the tooth. In the New Testament, it says every sin is forgivable except for blasphemy against the Holy Spirit. So I guess it just depends on you as an individual. But we live in a first world country where, like you said, we've housed 1/4 of the world's population prisoners. It seems like there should be some kind of standard on our reason for the death penalty and what it produces. Does it force somebody to repent? Is a human allowed to take another human's life, even though another human might have taken another? Those are the kind of questions that every state department must answer in every Department of Corrections, and nobody probably has all the answers. But I just want to read off the states that don't allow the death penalty: Alaska, Connecticut, Hawaii, Illinois, Iowa, Maine, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota, New Jersey, New Mexico, North Dakota, Rhode Island, Vermont, West Virginia, Wisconsin, the D.C. area, Guam, Northern Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico, and U.S. Virgin Islands. All those places do not have a death penalty statute in place. So,
mm-hmm.
And I had a friend, my friend Francine, she had a boyfriend she was dating, and he had another friend. And one time they left California for a road trip. And supposedly they drove into Texas. I think they went there for work, like for 2 months of labor or training on the job or something. And I guess they had some marijuana on them or something. And they got thrown in jail and prison for 6 months. And nobody had any money to help them. And there's certain states that you don't dare commit crimes in, and Texas is one of them. So people got to be aware of what the laws are, too. I mean, most murder is not premeditated. So a lot of those drug deals gone wrong or robberies, you know, I'm giving the best point of view for humanity. Like, I don't think people wake up every day with an intent to kill unless they're in the mob or something. But if you do end up killing somebody, then, you know, you have to realize that's like the worst thing you can do as a human is kill somebody. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, our country, goes to every part of the world to go kill somebody. I mean, look at Vietnam. You look at North Korea and South Korea, you know, we assisted South Korea.
Or even Iraq.
You look at all the other countries, Iraq, Afghanistan. The list goes on. We even supported Israel during a couple of battles against Palestinians. List goes on. We've always been supported, and we've always been in wars, in somebody's wars, or somehow in a war directly or a proxy war. You know, so our country leaders have, you know, order us to kill people all the time, but they're never prosecuted for anything, for any other people dying. So what's wrong with that picture?
Well, I'll tell you something. Russia has had the same foreign policy objectives. They've always been an expansionist country. They've always tried to expand their territory, and they're doing it now in Syria. I think America was misguided from 1945 to 1975 when we went into Korea to try to save them from communism. Half the country, at least South Korea, we tried to go into Vietnam to remedy the French dilemma of the French were imperialists there, and then they couldn't salvage Vietnam, and Vietnam had their own movement towards communism. And we went in there and tried to stop it. So I'll give the U.S. a pardon up until 75. But then when in 74, when Nixon started bombing the shit out of the Cambodians and ruthlessly killing them, and then also doing terrible air raids of North Vietnamese, then it was brutal murder.
Back in Vietnam,
yeah. Napalm and Agent Orange. So, then Bush and Cheney's objective to go into Iraq in 2003 was strictly political. The Iraqis had nothing to do with 9/11. It was a bin Laden operation. Everybody knows that now. 250,000 Iraqis died, civilians that weren't even part of, then there was a rift between the Sunnis and the Shias because Saddam's Sunni power had been in power so long that when the Shias started taking higher posts in government after the U.S. invaded and conquered, then there was resentment by the Sunnis to the Shias, and that's how the whole ISIS thing started, which is something we talked about last week.
I know how to start it. But here's the funny thing. Like, okay, what about when we went to Iraq, okay? And we talked, and Saddam, first of all, when Saddam came into power, our country supported Saddam, and they gave him money and they gave him all kinds of stuff and supported him because, he was against Iran.
Iran? Well, that was during the 1980-88 Civil War.
Yeah.
900,000 people died a million people died in that war. 500,000 on each side, Iraqi and Iran. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. And so we supported Iraq, and we supported Saddam. And Jesus Christ, I mean, our country leaders were meeting up with Saddam personally, face to face, shaking hands on TV and whatnot. They loved Saddam. And then and then all of a sudden Saddam starts selling oil other than American dollars. And so our corporate interests were we were losing money on the oil Saddam was getting rid of selling. And so now we finally stepped in and decided to take Saddam out of power because, he invaded Kuwait, and we made a big deal about him invading Kuwait, even though when he was attacking other countries, we support him anyways. Our final decision was like, oh, now he's got a nuclear bomb. Okay, now we got a real choice to defend ourselves, supposedly, and take him out. And we took him out, and guess what? He never had nuclear bombs. There's no nuclear bombs whatsoever. And the thing is that we could have taken Saddam out a long time ago when Saddam was convicting atrocities against his own civilian people. I mean, he used chemical weapons on his own people.
Kurds. It was mainly the Kurds.
Yeah. Well, Saddam, a lot of people say that Saddam was a brutal, evil dictator all his
entire
time.
Well, I do have a point about that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's auto-rewind a second. We never loved Saddam. We just used just like we supported bin Laden when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, because bin Laden back then was a rebel organization and he wasn't an international threat. We only supported Saddam because we didn't want Iran to win the Iraqi-Iran war. So he became a regional hegemon and his ego got too big, similar to Donald Trump. And Saddam wanted to be a regional hero like Nasser was in Egypt several years earlier. So to make a long story short, we only supported Saddam to our benefit. But then the reason that we decided to take Saddam out based on George Bush and Cheney's decision, is he was getting sort of out of hand, but there was also regional imbalance in the area. And Cheney and Bush had an objective to funnel oil all the way from a northern country into the Persian Sea so we could access it. So it was only pretty much an economic objective.
Oh, yeah, of course. It was, you know. And, you know, I mean, and we could have taken out Saddam a long time ago when he was committing all these things against his own people. They we finally took him out because of our own profit agenda. And that's terrible, you know. I mean, we never... Our country supposedly fights for other countries' democracy, you know, against communism. Like you said, when they try to take out North Korea, but every time I really see our country acting, it's always late. It's always many years after the brutal dictator has been harassing people and they finally decide to do something about it. Because now it has something to do with their oil or with some kind of stuff that are for our profit agenda, you know. And
well,
maybe
this is something we can save for the next show because I'll tell you why. I did a paper on Saddam Hussein and the Bush Doctrine and exactly how democracy failed in Iraq, how George Bush would never be able to implement it. And there's several factors. And the main factor is that Iraq did not have a civil society to support democracy. And what I mean by a civil society is that they didn't have a group of wealthy private people that could support institutions like education, art museums, and stuff like that. When you're in a country run strictly by a domineering government and people don't have any rights, you can't just automatically transfer to a democracy.
Well,
so,
look at Israel. Israel is under constant war. They're under attack all the time. And if you look at democracy in many countries, you look at Israel, how they managed to keep democracy under so many of battles and attacks. They've been under so many, compared to other democracy countries, Israel has been under the worst of all kinds of attacks and, you know,
democracy, but they don't have public freedoms like we do in America. It's a small country. They have a strong local and national defense. Every citizen, man and woman, is required to serve 2 years in the army between the ages of 18 and 25. It's a mandatory obligation. There's all kinds of factors of Israel that are so different from other countries that you can really not compare it, not to mention that it's also within a biblical context of the Abrahamic promises that were given to the Israeli people, and the Palestinians feel like they have a right to some of those biblical promises. And it's too complicated to go into at this time of night. But anyways, I didn't hear Don come back on the show, so it's 12. We've been on the air 75 minutes, so I'm going to draw my conclusion now. Don? Yeah, he's. I'm going to close him out of the show. So my conclusion basically is that I learned a lot from the video that you referred me to tonight, Hacking Democracy. I'm glad that I got a multi-layered objective beyond what happened in Election 2000. And I'm happy that I learned more things about voter-producing corporations that create those machines and also the bias that they carry. And I'm happy to have had you on the show a second time, and feel free to join us again Sunday night. And what's your conclusion for the night?
Well, my conclusion, you know, I mean, again, again, I would mention it again because, I mean, it's really important. I mean, the worst thing that can happen to our political system is corruption. And corruption is done by money. And money is brought to you by our richest people. And so we got to get rid of that chain and demolish that chain. We got to we got to get the, you know, from, we got to get the ability.
Are you trying
to
suggest power? We have to get more economic power in order to eliminate some of the rich?
Yeah. No, I mean, no, we got not enough, you know, wealthy people to buy politics, you know, because if you look at our presidential candidates that had contributions from all kinds of billionaires, you know, even look at the Koch brothers, they contributed to not just Republicans, but Democrats, too. So it's really ridiculous that, you know, they have so much influence in politics, you know. The only people that should have influence in politics is everybody individually, not just a handful of the 1%. And that's
I agree with you that they have power and influence, but they failed to overcome Obama twice. So they're not, as Michael Moore said in his movie Fahrenheit 9/11, it's one man, one vote, and they can never take that away from us. Now, in terms of the super delegate thing we talked about tonight, that system needs some correcting. But I forgot to mention to you earlier that the original reason for the Electoral College is because all the people represented in government when they created the Constitution, they didn't trust the ordinary man just to elect a president by popular vote. And that's why they created the Electoral College, because they did want to have some secure hold of the elite managing the final results of the election. That's the reality of it, I'm sorry to tell you. It was the white land-owning people that determined that an electoral college would be the best way to secure the wisest choice for presidency. And they didn't think that uneducated people could make that wise decision.
And of course, you know, look how the system is now. I mean, look at even just a couple, just a dozen years ago, when our company, United States is in more debt, and extremely more debt than it was before, just a dozen years ago, because our banks, our big banks, from Goldman Sachs and the Lehman Brothers, you know, that even had politics in our own, even Greenspan, right? Greenspan, right? They worked with George Bush, and he ran the whole the taxes and whatnot. But even he received money from the Koch brothers and whatnot. And I mean, and you look at all those dumb things they did, and put America in a huge amount of debt, thanks to Goldman Sachs and the Lehman Brothers. You know, I mean, I can go kind of into detail, but we're kind of running out of time. But yeah, I mean, you get the gist of it, you know. Huh? Hello. Can you hear me?
Alan Greenspan was the chairman of the Federal Reserve of the U.S. from 87 to 2006. He was a very effective, even-handed reserve person. It didn't really get that corrupt until he left. Then we found out in the there was a movie that I rented from Netflix. It had to do with the 2008 Wall Street crash. Anyways, we found out that Goldman Sachs had like 8 out of 10 people on the Federal Money Reserve Board. And from 2006 on, after Greenspan left, it was determined that it was a corrupt, one-sided organization that was only preserving the interests of the rich. But Alan Greenspan was a good leader. He kept the federal interest down for several years.
Bernie Sanders has a lot of bad things to say about Greenspan, actually.
Say what?
Greenspan, Bernie Sanders is running for president.
I hear you, but your phone's breaking up. Your phone is breaking up.
Oh, no, I'm saying that's not what Bernie Sanders said about Greenspan. If you look at some of the videos many years back again, when Bernie Sanders had conversations with Greenspan, he's got a lot of bad things to say about him. You can look at the YouTube videos on Bernie Sanders talking with Greenspan.
One thing that Greenspan screwed up on was there was a savings and loan scandal in the 90s. In which a lot of savings and loan places in the United States didn't follow the rule of law, and they didn't have all the reserves in their bank that they needed. And a lot of they were like credit unions, but they were called saving and loan something. Anyways, they actually collapsed sometime in the 80s or 90s, and it was a big hassle. But with that, I'm going to have to end the show because I can't jump from topic to topic. And we've been on the air 90 minutes, and we can't keep going because Blog Talk Radio doesn't allow it. So you can catch us Sunday night. Would you like to join Sunday night too, or if you want?
I'm going to actually be out of town, so I won't be able to on this weekend.
Okay, that's okay. I'll text you when the next midweek show is, okay? That would be in the middle of next week. And then if you can join us Wednesday or Thursday of next week, we'd be happy to have you on the air, okay?
Give me your Gmail because I want to email you some important links that I have in my Gmail.
Okay, I use Yahoo every day, and I only use Gmail like once a week. So I'll text you my Yahoo email. Okay.
Okay. Thank you for the Yahoo email. I'm gonna send you some really important information. You should look at.
Yeah, I'll be happy to take any of your show and topic ideas. Okay. Have a great night and God bless you. Okay.
Okay. You too.
Have fun when you're going out of town this weekend. Thank you.
Good
night.
Thank you.
Good night.